Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half hour of interviews on politics, the environment, and more. TalkNation.org for news and discussion. I'm Dori Smith. Our guest this time is author and scholar Michael Parenti, who will be telling us about his latest book, Super Patriots. First, these news updates. As discussions in the U.S. press center on the writing of an Iraqi constitution, civilian Iraqis appear caught between forces of civil war and occupation. The White House and President Bush have indicated that Iraqi acceptance of a written constitution will bring peace, security, and democracy. However, the foreign press is describing a less than democratic process going on in the Green Zone as Shiite and Kurdish leaders push Sunni voices out with U.S. support. Sunni negotiators had called on the UN and international community for help to prevent the largely Shiite government from coming to an agreement on a constitution without their approval. But speaking from an Idaho resort town Wednesday, the 24th of August, George Bush said, quote, "This talk about Sunnis rising up, I mean the Sunnis have got to make a choice. Do they want to live in a society that's free, or do they want to live in violence?" Bush was quoted by Rory Carroll in The Guardian. Dexter Filkins reported in the New York Times that Shiite leaders have threatened to, quote, ram the Constitution through the National Assembly without Sunni support. And Al-Qaeda is warning Sunni leaders not to organize an opposition vote to the Constitution. Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia issued a warning to Sunni clerics not to, quote, urge their faithful to take part in the referendum on the Constitution, according to Dexter Filkins. An increase in violence in western Iraq has Iraqi doctors calling for emergency assistance for a humanitarian crisis, according to U.S. journalist Dar Jamail. DarJamailIraq.com is his blog. Doctors in Iraq have called for an investigation into violations of the Geneva Convention by the U.S. They say refugees are fleeing western Iraq as the U.S. Marines use airstrikes there. U.S. and Iraqi fighting is going on in Haditha, Rawa, Parwana, and Heat. The Guardian has also reported that Haditha is in chaos. Assassinations there and the killing of a U.S. journalist named Stephen Vincent have made the town too dangerous for most journalists to cover. Finally, at least half of $1.27 billion in funds earmarked for Iraq's security forces have been embezzled, according to a Guardian story by Ed Valamy, Richard Norton Taylor, and Jason Rodriguez. 9 Iraqi ministry officials appointed by the U.S. have been fired. An Iraqi report found questionable no-bid contracts to weapons suppliers and cash payments paid in advance. These funds are in addition to nearly $9 billion missing from the Iraq reconstruction budget overseen by the Coalition Provisional Authority. As of January 2005, there were reports of possible ghost employees on the ministry's payroll. Our guest today is Michael Parenti. His latest book is Super Patriots. You can learn more about Super Patriots and other titles by Michael Parenti on his website, michaelparenti.org. That's P-A-R-E-N-T-I for Parenti. Super patriotism, he says, can manifest itself in religion, sports, the military, schools, and big business. I asked Michael Parenti to give us a definition of super patriotism and to talk about the contents of his new book.
It's the very troubling aspects of U.S. foreign policy that led me to raise some critical questions about the way the term and the concept of patriotism and love of country are used to justify all the kind of crimes that are being perpetrated in the name of patriotism. Our U.S. rulers play upon people's patriotism and love of country to get them to go along with policies that do not serve the interests of the American people and do not serve the interests of people in other countries. Under the guise of defending freedom, protecting us from terrorism, and the like, those of us who love our country are supposed to fall into line and support the invasion of Panama, the invasion of Grenada, the occupation of Somalia, the sending troops to Lebanon, the building of 700 major military bases in 56 different countries, the bombing of Yugoslavia for 78 days nonstop, the invasion and occupation of Iraq, the menacing threats toward Iran, North Korea, China, the constant conjuring up of adversaries who may threaten us, and under the guise of defending us from these threats and such, people fall into line. In fact, what U.S. rulers are doing are building a global empire that serves the needs of giant multinational corporations that batten on the huge contracts that are set forth. Consider Iraq, for instance, the billions of dollars that Halliburton and Bechtel and other companies, about 70 other companies, have made, billions and billions of dollars in profits, a lot of it unaccountable, a lot of it not even properly supervised, in Iraq. Well, you see, to say that Bush's policy in Iraq has backfired or is a failure is not true. It's quite successful for certain interests. They're sitting on $5 trillion worth of oil in Iraq. They have no exit strategy. People say they have no exit strategy, as if you're really exposing their stupidity and all that. But they have no exit strategy because they don't want any exit strategy. They're not intending to exit. They're sitting on $5 trillion worth of oil, the largest oil grab in the history of humanity. And to justify all of this, they wave the flag in people's faces, and many people fall into line. And those of us who criticize such policies and say, wait a minute, these policies are built on deception, these policies benefit the privileged investing class at the expense of the U.S. taxpayers, and we expend our taxes and the blood of our sons and daughters and husbands and wives and brothers and sisters, whatever, to support that. And people fall into line because the flag is waved and you're told to be a good American, that you got to back the president, and that's that. And those of us who are critics are accused of lacking patriotism. You must be making these criticisms because you don't love your country. For some strange reason, you live here, you work here and all that, but you don't love your country the way I love my country, and I love my country because I unquestioningly submit to whatever the president wants. He wants more taxes to support his wars. I pay more taxes. He wants the blood of my son or daughter or brother or whatever. I go along with that too. Well, that such a person is not the citizen of a democracy. Such a person is not the citizen of a democratic polity. He's a citizen of a totalitarian mentality. And so patriotism has been used in this way. I call it super patriotism because it's an unthinking, knee-jerk thing which equates more and more military expenditure and military strength with patriotism. It equates attacking and waging wars on other people with love of country and the like. And most of these super patriots know very little about the history of their country. They know very little about the really wonderful things in our history. So you wonder what it is they really love about their country. They know very little about the struggles for the eight-hour day, the struggles for organized labor, the struggles for public education, for medical care for the ill and indigent, the struggle for decent housing, the struggles against racism and segregation, the struggles against sexism, against class oppression, the fight for progressive income taxes and such. Many of these victories being now undone by the Bush administration in the last 20 years, by the Reagan administration and others. So they don't. What is it they love about the country? They know very little about the darker side of our history also, about the terrible epic of slavery, about the terrible oppression of working people in America, child labor, the terrible conditions of our medical industry, our pharmaceuticals and the like. And you can go on and on and on, the plight and the plunder and desecration of the environment. There's that other whole side, which they don't even want to look at. And if you do criticize, they see you as being, again, anti-American and lacking in patriotism. So patriotism for these people is to be a mindless, flag-waving, follow-the-leader sort of drone, you know.
We're talking with Michael Parenti. He's author of Democracy for the Few, and that book's been used by many college professors to teach classes on the other side of U.S. history, not often taught in high school, certainly. Often, I think, Professor Parenti, your book, Democracy for the Few, is one of the first shocks that college students ever get to show some of the other sides of the country that they're living in.
That's true, yeah.
Now, talking about this super patriotism, though, and U.S. foreign policy, talk about the fact that the White House has so many problems now addressing the American people about the facts on the ground. The violence in Iraq's getting worse. There are signs that the country is split between new forces that may be more leaning toward Iran than America, and that the government that was helped into office by the U.S. is filled with problems and possibly gearing up for civil war by creating paramilitary forces.
Saddam Hussein, in his worst days as a torturer and a murderer and an oppressor, was supported by the CIA and the U.S. government. He was Washington's poster boy. He was put in. He was backed for assassination gigs back in 1959. He was the man who destroyed and killed and murdered every communist, every progressive, every Democrat, every constitutionalist, or drove him in exile or underground. He even wiped out the whole left wing of his own Ba'athist Party. And when he was doing all of that, he was Washington's hero. They gave him aid. They had nothing but the highest praise for him. It's when he got out of line on the oil quotas and oil prices, and he wanted a bigger share of the market to sell, and they were worried about oil prices dropping. It was when he proved himself not to be a complete comprador leader, opening up his country completely to foreign investment on terms that were entirely favorable to the big foreign investors. When he started doing that, this was when they started finding fault with him. He started committing economic nationalism. He kept the whole economy publicly owned rather than privatizing it, handing it over to the corporations at garage sale prices. He trained cadres of engineers. He started developing Iraq. Now, Iraq is a very crucial nation in the Middle East. If you ever look at the map of the Middle East, it is the hub, the center. It borders on six other very important countries, including Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Iran and Syria. It's the one country. A lot of countries in the Middle East have water but no oil, or oil but no water. Iraq had both. It's very prosperous. It had a standard of living that was the highest in the Middle East. Today, it's a country that's been reduced to utter desperation and destruction. And what the U.S. has done is worsen the conditions of the people, increase the dangers of violence and death, destroyed the economy. I was just reading about a U.S. Marine who's come back, and he said he went to Iraq thinking he was going to be fighting and defending people and helping reconnect their water supply and electricity and sewage systems. And in fact, he was put on parole to guard the oil wells and pipelines. And he said large numbers of the troops, that's why the military force, the U.S. military force in Iraq, one of the reasons why it's so ineffectual is a huge chunk of it. Nobody ever talks about that. A huge chunk of it is out there guarding the wellheads and the pipelines and whatever else, and having a hard time of it, too, because it's hard to guard and patrol hundreds of miles of pipeline. This is what's developed. There wasn't an Al-Qaeda terrorist network in Iraq until the U.S. invasion. Today, they've attracted every group, cell, perpetrator, whatever else. Every violent nut that you can think of is now in that country, blowing up things and killing people. They're not, I'm sorry to say, the insurgency is not a people's war of national liberation, which would build cadres and help the people and build schools and whatever things the way such wars of national liberation are done in some countries. It's just the hit-and-run groups made worse, as I say, attracting and multiplying in numbers with every day of the U.S. occupation. So the occupation has really, really been the worst thing for peace, the worst thing for the well-being of the Iraqi people, and it's now creating a Frankenstein monster that will lead, as you said, to civil war, probably, and to the most extreme form of Islamic oppression. And the longer the U.S. stays there, the worse it gets, despite the window dressing of a constitution and an election. But 90% of the violence and such is because of the U.S. presence and occupation. Even the people who say, yes, I'm glad you overthrew Saddam Hussein, now would you please go home? That's what they say. So that's really the answer. And what I would invite people to do is look at the underlying interests behind all these interventions. Why does this country, why do these rulers feel so compelled to have to intervene everywhere, have troops in 56 different countries, getting involved in military actions in Somalia, Yugoslavia, Panama, Grenada, supporting all sorts of other groups in Colombia and all through Latin America, fighting everywhere to make the world safe for the Fortune 500, to make the world safe for George Bush's plutocracy and reactionaries. And that has nothing to do with patriotism and nothing to do with freedom, nothing to do with national security, and nothing to do with democracy. It's just the opposite. It creates more problems for all of us. But it gives them a lot of gains and a lot of advantages.
And so with this juncture we're at, with the peace movement very active, with people hoping they might be able to make a difference still, just talk about this whole idea of fixing what's wrong in Iraq from the point of view of what can the White House still do and the military, and then the point of view of how peace activists can be effective and what they can call for and try to do.
My point is, it's incorrect to say that the Iraq policy isn't working. It is working. It is working. It's doing what they want. They've got control of the oil, and they're exporting it, and they've stripped a government that was 95% state-owned, and they're privatizing it. They have special committees to privatize it. They've taken a country that was self-defining and self-developing, and it is now an impoverished, prostrate, devastated country where people will line up to work for slave wages or become members of the police or army because it's the only jobs they can get and serve as adjuncts to U.S. imperialism. The policy is working for certain very select interests. And as far as everyone else, to hell with them. It doesn't matter. And so the peace movement should be making it clear, you know, cui bono, who benefits from this policy? And to assume that nobody is benefiting, nobody is being served, this is just a total disaster. It's just getting worse and worse. If you think your enemies, who control so much power, so much of the world, so much wealth, if you think they're stupid, you're being stupid. They know what the hell they're doing. Of course, there's been unexpected and very costly responses, and they didn't expect an insurgency of the kind they got. They thought it would be a walk-in and a waltz. But they're not paying the price on that. They're even profiting from that. It's enabling them to boost the military U.S. military budget to record heights, $440 billion, not to mention the off-budget expenditures day-to-day in Iraq, which come to billions, $1.5 billion a day more, which will starve out the human services here at home, give them greater justification to cut back on Social Security payments and Medicare and housing and education, all those things, get us back to a third world nation. Their goal is the impoverishment of the world. The poorer they can make you or the Iraqis or other people, the poorer and hungrier they can make people, the harder those people will work for less and less, and the more profits they themselves will make. So that's where I see the policy going. And as I said, they have no exit policy because they have no intention of exiting. They have been in Korea for 50 years, a half a century, and they're quite prepared to stay in Iraq for half a century. They won't say that to people because they're losing, you know, 50 to 70 soldiers and Marines a month. But that's a sustainable loss. You know, Richard Nixon was losing 110 a week in Vietnam, and he got reelected in 1972 by a landslide. And even among the people who lose their children, you get these interviews, a lot of them, a lot, not all, but a lot of them come out and say, my son wanted to serve, and I'm proud of him, and he died so that we could be free. And it's the land of the free because we have the home of the brave, because the brave have made us free. And I mean, there are people in America who really think we're defending freedom in Iraq. We're defending our own freedom. And the whole trick is to try to, as I tried to do in the book, Super Patriotism, to try to show them that this isn't in their interest, but it is in the interests of other people.
We've been interviewing people here on Talk Nation, like Gareth Porter, who have discussed the idea that we need to identify those in Iraq who might need to negotiate so that we can try to help stabilize Iraq and provide a way toward peace talks.
It really varies. It's really a mess because you have Shiite and Sunni who are already at loggerheads and killing each other and doing preliminary civil war. You have Shiites and Sunni who are working together and saying there are no differences, we're all Iraqis, and we have only one common enemy, which the U.S. should get out now. And you have Kurds who want to collaborate, but most Kurds are, or the element that has been most supported and financed by the U.S. is the separatist element, because the function of the Kurds is to be a separatist, undermining the existing Iraqi government. So if they can negotiate and get a broad-based coalition which says we're going to live in peace and restructure our government and we don't need you Americans now, and we've put a damper enough on the insurgents and the terrorists so you can go home now, that would be very nice. And yes, sure, we should support those elements. But it doesn't really look like those are the people who are calling the tune. You know, there's just so much one can say, or one could go on and on. But underlying the assumption here is that the U.S. has a right to be in any country it wants to go to and try to solve, supposedly, or at least pretend to solve, the problems of that country, when in fact it's the creator of many of the worst problems. And that mission is the messianic mission. I talk about that in Super Patriotism, that there's a presumption not only among the leaders, but it's propagated among large sections of our population, that our country, for some reason, has been called upon by history to go forth and define the fates and destinies of other countries and define how they shall develop, how they shall govern themselves. The idea that the U.S. rulers have the right to go into Iraq to help them and teach them how to govern themselves. Here's a 5,000-year-old civilization where many of the things in Western civilization started in Iraq. I mean, things like the alphabet and writing and this, that, and the other thing. And to announce that we've come to help these lesser people who somehow are just lesser. They're not really quite as sharp or as gifted or as great as we Americans are. And they could be Iraqis today. Yesterday they were Panamanians. The day before they were Croatians and Serbians. And again, there's this presumption of supremacy. There's this presumption of the U.S. being God's gift to humanity, God's gift to history, and that it will step forward and it will guide these countries. And meanwhile, what they're doing is bombing villages, destroying their farms, destroying their homes, killing large numbers of them, blasting away, and they're hated. And if we are so gifted, if we are so generous, if we are so much the savior throughout the world, why are we so hated? And George Bush was asked that question. I have a whole chapter in the book. It's a short chapter. Why do they hate us? And he said, I don't know. We're such wonderful people. Well, it must be, they're just crazy. They just hate us. Why don't you take a look at what they say? They say, leave us alone. You come in, you take over our country, you steal our resources, you push aside our governments, you support the most retrograde, repressive elements in our society, you set up dictatorships when we had started democratic movements, you do all this, you steal our markets, our land, our capital, our labor, our natural resources, and all the while you're preaching to us about democracy and peace and love and freedom and all that stuff. And the truth is, your whole policy is based on lies and hypocrisy. And the only way we're going to get this through to your people is by bringing the war home to you. And this is what they say. Now, I don't back those people. I hate all these forms of violence and madness that are going on. But you can understand that they're not waging war against America because they're just so jealous. Osama bin Laden was right when he said, if we're fighting you just because we don't like you because you're so free and you're so prosperous and you're so democratic, then why don't we attack Sweden or Denmark? They're freer and more prosperous and more democratic than you are. He said, we attack you because you're over here. Our war is not a war of aggression against you. It's a war of retaliation. If you leave us alone, we'll leave you alone. And that's what they say again and again, and that's the message that is played down. Instead, what Americans believe is we've got some mission with destiny or history to save the world and be the superpower leaders of the world. And in fact, having so much power, you even get media pundits who then transcribe that power into entitlement. We are a superpower, and we better act like a superpower. We have the right to. We have the power. Therefore, we have the right to. And we got to get out there, and we got to make those decisions and take on those responsibilities. Who said so? Who said and why? If you're so hot to prove how great America is, why don't you start right here at home and start solving some of the problems right here in the U.S. that are so immense and so troubling, instead of running to every little corner of the world to go bomb and occupy and spend billions of dollars of our tax money while we get poorer and poorer here at home.
Michael Parenti is author of 18 books. His new book is Super Patriots. Other works include Democracy for the Few, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Rome, which was the nonfiction book of the year in 2004. He's also written The Terrorism Trap, To Kill a Nation, Against Empire, History as Mystery, America Besieged, Dirty Truths, Land of Idols, Inventing Reality, and many more titles. You'll find his books at Alibris, BookSense Online, and other fine bookstores. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. TalkNation.org for news and discussion. This program was produced in the studios of listener-supported WHUS Stores, radio for the people at the University of Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live Wednesdays at 5.